The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 22nd, 2008, and this is episode number 115. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk to you about MotoGP and all kinds of good stuff related to motorcycles and various things along that line. Well, actually, just motorcycles. All right. Well, we didn't get any donations through PayPal this week, so nobody to thank for that. But I do want to send a big shout out to Mark Callen, longtime friend of MotoGPOD. He sent me a big book of stamps that I can send my son, who's in boot camp, like I said. Last week kind of went on and on about that. I thought that was pretty cool. So big shout out. Thank you very much to Mark. Do appreciate it. That's kind of cool. And on top of that, they're motorcycle stamps. So that was kind of cool. Thank you very, very much, Mark. I do appreciate it. Another note that we've got going on about various friends and colleagues of MotoGPOD. Steve Jones has got his USMotoGPFans.com. That's USMotoGPFans.com website. He's got a couple of auctions going on right now for his suites that he's got at Laguna Seca and Miller Motorsports Park. And you got to check this out. If you want to go see the races in style down there at Laguna Seca, I'd encourage you to check it out. It's a pretty good deal. And I keep sort of kicking myself for not taking advantage of it, but it seems like I always end up going to the races with friends that just aren't willing to drop that much sort of coin for the race tickets. And I'm not saying I have a bad experience when I do it. I mean, I like my sort of on the cheap method just fine as well. I really do. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool deal. You get, you know, food and a place, air conditioning, which can be really nice in Laguna Seca in July and even Utah. So it's a good deal. It's worth looking at. And check it out, usmotogpfans.com. He's got auctions going on right there, right now, for these fantastic, sweet deals. And let's see. Oh, don't forget about the Chicken Hawk Racing competition. You remember last week we had David Podolsky from Chicken Hawk Racing on, and he talked a lot about tires and tire warmers and all kinds of stuff. And we're going to have a contest going on to give away a set of Ben Spies's, this actual tire warmers used by Ben Spies. You know, these are all marked up, Suzuki all over them and all that kind of good stuff. He's going to give a set of those away. So that's a very, very cool prize. All you got to do to enter that, if you haven't entered yet, is go to chickenhawkracing.com and sign up for the email list he has there. It's not a high volume list. You're not going to get a bunch of junk mail. Don't worry about it. Just sign up on his list. And then in the address line 2, this is the important part, so he knows why you're signing up. The address line 2, when you're filling out your physical street address, put MotoGPOD on the address line 2. If you actually have an address that requires 2 lines, just kind of shoehorn it in somehow, somewhere, some way, and David will take care of making sure that you're on the list to get some information maybe from him, and also that you're in the hat to be have your name possibly drawn out to get a set of Ben Spies's tire warmers, which is, like I said, pretty cool prize. I mean, if all else fails, you can actually use these as tire warmers, or, you know, you can have this kind of cool sort of, you know, prior racer trophy. I mean, you know, these guys give away stuff like, you know, knee pucks, you know, a used knee slider by Nikki Hayden, you know, it's all great, you know, scuffed up piece of plastic. This is a, you know, set of tire warmers. So it's pretty cool stuff. And that's a great prize. I do thank David Podolsky a lot. I think the call was super interesting and the contest is super good too. Been a really, really busy week. I got tons of email. This has been probably the biggest email week that I've had, certainly in a very long time and possibly ever. I got way, way behind. I was answering emails like 3 or 4 days after they were sent, so I kind of apologize for that. I do like to answer the emails, appreciate it a lot. One thing that I've gotten a ton of email about is the shift pattern, because I told you guys a week or two ago that I bought an SV650, a 2003 SV650, as a track bike, and it's all race prepped and this and that, and it was actually a racer and owned by by Mark Sorensen, who did the American Road Racer calendar a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, didn't do a 2008 one. I was really heartbroken about that. And he might be back in 2009. I hope so. Let's cross our fingers. But in any event, Mark Sorensen used to own this motorcycle. He sold it to a guy that I met in Portland, met online, and I ended up buying it for him. One of those funny, weird, you know, internet coincidences, right? But this motorcycle has a race shift pattern, like I mentioned a week or two ago, and I've gotten I don't know how many emails about this on both sides of the issue, because I mentioned that I was probably going to change it back to a standard pattern just because that's what I'm used to, and I don't want to sort of screw myself up so that when I'm out riding on the street, I accidentally try to shift in a race pattern, or that when I'm on the track, I accidentally, you know, bang a downshift instead of an upshift, or whatever. So basically, both motorcycles need to be the same thing. Gotten a ton of emails on both sides of the issue with a whole lot of variety. I'm going to pick one of them out, and it's not quite at random. I think this is one of the better ones. They're all good, though. Thank you very much, guys. I do appreciate all of the input. But this one's from Brent Porter. And Brent says, "Hello, Bob. Just wanted to drop a line with my 2 cents worth as a fellow SV650 rider. Raced one for several years in the CCS and CRA. He said, I did several years of track days before actually racing. My first season of racing, I decided to switch to a GP shift pattern, and I did it prior to racing during a couple of early spring track days. It was a bit awkward at first, and I did mess up a few times, mostly when I started upping the pace a bit or when getting into traffic. After 2 track days with reverse shifting, it felt so much more natural than the stock 1 down and 5 up. Another listener mentioned in an email that you read in your last cast, it really is more efficient pushing down with your toe while shifting without using the clutch. You can stay tucked under better, and you can concentrate more on the track ahead instead of taking a tiny bit of focus away from the track to make sure you're clicking your toe up enough. It's much easier to miss a shift when you're pulling your toe up while trying to run through the gears as fast as possible, as opposed to pushing your toe down. With the SV650, I found it much easier to blip with my thumb while up-clicking with your toe. This is for a downshift. It feels very natural since you sit up a bit to brace for heavy braking. I'd get my toe under the shifter right as I hit my brake marker, pull the brake lever with 2 fingers while rolling the thumb each time that I quickly pull the clutch and lift my toe. For some reason, when you're doing all of those mechanics with your hands, it just feels right to pull the toe up rather than push down. He says, I only write this because I wish I would have done this right away when I started doing track days, because it shaved some time off during my first race season, but it took a full season before I really felt 100% natural with it. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. He said, I'll most likely run all my bikes in the future this way. And this is the telling point here in this email, and one of the reasons I picked this one. He has last paragraph. He says, I was curious why street motorcycles come stock with the 1 down and 5 up shifting pattern rather than 1 up and 5 down. Is this just one of those things in which it was originally that way, so why change it now or what? So, and then actually that's not the case, because there's all kinds of different shift patterns that they've tried on motorcycles through the ages as they, evolved into what they are now. And I compared it to the sort of VHS beta thing. It might have been that. Another thing, actually thinking about it more, I'll bet you it's because you're largely targeting a guy that's just riding on the street and he's poking around. And when you go to a stoplight to get down into first, you're just sort of banging it down. And, you know, since I think a lot of people are relatively sloppy in their shifting habits, they certainly are in cars, and I wouldn't doubt they are in motorcycles. So what they do is, you know, they're up into, say, I don't know, third gear or so in town, and when they stop, they just stop instead of downshifting and slowing using the engine braking rather than just the brakes and all that sort of thing. So then you just bang down because it's kind of easier when you're standing there with, you know, 1 foot on the ground and all that sort of thing. So that's my new theory. I like that one. All right, carrying on. Like I said, we've got a lot of emails about shift patterns, so I am kind of done with it. Won't talk about it anymore. One more thing. Actually, I will talk about it a little tiny bit more, because one more thing, what I've decided I think I'm going to do with my track bike and my street bike is, for my first track day or two, I think I'm going to put the SV back to a normal shift pattern. I'm going to be getting used to a new motorcycle with a much more aggressive riding position, a variety of different factors going on. I don't really need the distraction of trying to make sure that I don't screw up a shift. So I'll just go ahead and go to a standard shift pattern for that. But after that, I'm going to go ahead and try the race pattern and see how it works out for me. And if I can get used to it, which I probably can, I'm probably making a mountain out of a molehill on this as far as, you know, not being able to get used to it. Get used to it real fast, and then I might change my FZ to match just because it does make more sense in a lot of ways. So, moving on, Another item that I talked about in a couple of shows has been the whole Barry Sheen DVD, if you remember that. And there's a variety of very cool DVDs that Duke Video puts out, and probably a lot of other companies that you can get that are only available in PAL. And here in the United States, that can sometimes prove to be a problem. You know, you can watch them on your computer or hook your computer up to your television will often work. I know it does on Macintoshes. I think it will on Windows, that sort of thing. But, you know, sometimes it's just easier to just stick that thing in the DVD player and push go. So, Alan Clarkson Dodds in New Zealand. Boy, we get a lot of email from the Down Under. Actually, Alan is in America now, but he's from New Zealand. So, we get a lot of email from these guys. He says, blah, blah, blah. I noticed they point out a few times talking about the Barry Sheen documentary. Get a PAL DVD in the U.S. You have to watch it on your computer. He says, what you may or may not know, and I think it will help a lot of people here in the United States, is that non-tube televisions like LCD and plasma flat screens can display PAL video just fine. And that's something I should have remembered, and that's my bad. Then he says, the only issue now is the DVD player, but the majority of modern players are either multi-zone or can be very easily hacked with a password to make them multi-zone. And he mentions a site that has password, which is videohelp.com. And of course, I'll put a link to that on the website. And you go to videohelp.com and they'll give you some secret code that you type in on your remote and you'll unlock your DVD player. I haven't actually taken a look at the website, so I don't know how great it is, but it is a good tip. And that would give you the ability to play PAL DVDs or region whatever DVDs on your DVD player and display it. And as long as your whatever you're viewing it on, your display is capable of that PAL refresh rate, which most flat screens are, then you should be good to go. So thanks very much, Alan. Do appreciate that tip. That's good stuff. If for any of us that, you know, we're getting that Barry Sheen video from Duke or any of those other kind of things, the British Superbike highlights and all that sort of stuff that they don't release in NTSC. There's a lot of really good stuff out there if you take a look. And it's entertaining stuff during the off season, so you don't have to just sit around and listen to me going on and on and on and on the podcast. All right. For the rest of the show, we have some really great stuff. Scott Jones, longtime friend of MotoGPOD, who you may remember did a tech segment before for us about valves, did a fantastic tech segment on the Big Bang engine. We're going to have that coming up shortly. And we also got a call with Jules, where we're talking a little bit about the IRT race testing session that we just had happening at Jerez, where they gave away the BMW and all that good stuff. And also just the upcoming season, just kind of some general blathering on. So a variety of different things. And I think other than that, we're about ready to go. So let's get on with it. All right, we got a really cool treat right now. Longtime listener and friend of the podcast, Scott Jones, a prior contributor to MotoGPOD, has written up an article on Big Bang engines. Now, this is really good stuff. It's rather long, but it's always super interesting. And why don't we just go ahead and launch into it? We're going to talk about Big Bang engines versus Screamer engines, mostly about Big Bang. So, Scott writes, one way to look at MotoGP is as a continuing struggle to balance ever-increasing horsepower with a contact patch about the size of a compact disc. While common sense says that tire technology and suspension tuning have the most influence over where the limit of traction lies, for the last 2.5 decades, an element of internal engine architecture has had a profound effect on rear-wheel traction and overall rideability. MotoGP fans hear about the Big Bang engine. They mention it frequently. But what is it, and why does it improve a rider's control? The first question is easily explained, but the second is not. The idea behind a Big Bang engine is to move the pistons closer together around the crankshaft and make them fire in a quick succession, rather than every 180 degrees as in an engine with a normal firing order. And instead of firing each cylinder individually, you fire two cylinders at a time in a four-cylinder engine, creating two large bangs per firing cycle instead of four smaller ones. This concept has its roots in flat track racing, where Harley Big Bang V-twins dominated for decades. The premier class saw Big Bang engines in Suzuki test bikes in the early 1970s, and Kajiva tried their Bombardone engine in the mid-1980s. But it was Honda that made the Big Bang design an integral part of road racing with their 1992 NSR 500. With this bike, Mick Doohan handily won the first four races of the season and would likely have run away with the championship had he not crashed so badly in practice at Assen and missing the next four races. When Honda unveiled that big banger NSR 500 in 1992, the sound was dramatically different from the rest of the bikes on the grid. Other manufacturers brought audio analyzing equipment to the track to figure out what the hell Honda was doing differently. The audio trick worked, and soon later, the other teams were playing catch-up both on and off the track, putting their own big bangers into development to compete with the NSR 500. In the modern era, however, one can no longer tell for sure, just by the engine sound, whether or not it's a big banger or a rational firing order screamer. The many technological advances that MotoGP has seen since the early 1990s have removed those distinct audible differences of the engine design. Engineers now choose inline or V layouts. They single or multiple crankshafts, spring, mechanical or gas-powered valves, and so on and so forth. And each manufacturer must decide if a big bang layout works better with their other design choices better than a rational firing order. The 2007 season saw bikes on both sides of this fence. One company even switched sides in the middle of the season. This is the protean nature of MotoGP. The bikes are always changing as teams search for whatever combination of technology will produce even the slightest, tiniest advantage. Back to the 1990s and the NSR 500, as development of that big banger continued, engineers had to determine what degree of separation was optimal for the overall engine architecture. For example, The first responses to the 1992 NSR 500 were said to be a Kajiva that's fired its pistons 66 degrees apart and a Suzuki that found 15 degrees to be the magic number. The only constant was that big bang engines, combined with the technologies of the day, made for lower lap times, even as some very clever people wondered why this design made such a big difference to a bike's rideability. Given nature's bias against things that are out of balance, the Big Bang engine is a crazy idea that should create more problems than it could possibly solve. You may remember the right-hand rule from basic physics. Imagine an engine's crankshaft spinning on its case, and you turn your right hand in the same direction the crankshaft is turning. If you extend your right thumb, you've just identified a vector, or a gyro effect, that the spinning crankshaft is generating. And the faster that crankshaft is spinning, the stronger that vector is, and the harder it is for the rider to turn the bike away from that vector due to the gyroscopic effect. Dual crankshaft engines produce a better handling motorcycle by reducing the engine's internal gyro effects, but adding a heavy throbbing big bang to that firing cycle complicates this situation with its lopsided pulse. Such imbalance, especially in machines with as many moving parts as a motorcycle engine, usually leads to unwanted vibrations, which lead to inefficient function, which leads to loss of power, which leads to decreased performance and a slower speed. Then add to that equation the increased torque from the double piston firing at the same time and the close proximity of the timing, and this requires a heavier, stronger crankshaft, bearings, and gears. So you have a heavy, less efficient, imbalanced engine making fewer horsepower than the engine with a rational firing order. But that big banger just happens to have the advantage of increased rideability. And sometimes a given advantage is significant enough to outweigh the disadvantages. The loss of power is one thing, but as we know, MotoGP bikes have more power than they can efficiently use, so with power to spare, some vibration in the right place just might be a good thing. It is, according to a 1992 article by Kevin Cameron, who explained the Big Bang engine's benefit as an effective compensation for the increasing grip found when radial tires replaced bias ply tires. Do you remember those amazing high side crashes that we used to see so often in the 500cc era? The frequency of high sides reached a peak with the introduction of radial tires because those radials would grip like crazy until a certain point and then suddenly break loose, only to grip again just as suddenly a split second later. And this process happened so fast that a rider's perception could not detect it, and that meant that one moment he's riding at the limit and the next he's flying over the handlebars. Now, with bias ply tires, the transition from full grip to full sliding was more gradual, and the rider could feel the limit of traction approaching as the rear end of the bike started to hang out more and more. But with those new radial tires, by the time he found the limit of traction, it was way too late. So, how can the firing scheme of the engine give the rider better feedback about that rear tire grip? There are at least two theories about this. One theory suggests that while human perception is much too coarse to tell 1 millisecond from another, a MotoGP tire endures its very stressful and very short life by being profoundly affected by many forces, one distinct millisecond to the next. Not only is gravity forcing the tire against the road surface, but as the bike is leaning from side to side, the tire is fighting severe lateral pressure. The bike is also braking frequently, and most importantly for this discussion, it's accelerating with tremendous power. Under acceleration, the aforementioned milliseconds feel different to the tire because it senses each rotation of the crankshaft not as one steady force, but as an ever-changing pressure. As the cylinder fires for a very brief moment, that force that is pushing the tire forward is at its most intense. But quickly, that force decreases as the piston slows down a bit on its way to the bottom of the stroke. Once there, it reverses direction and heads back up on the exhaust stroke. If no other pistons were involved, it would continue to slow down on the intake and compression strokes until the next ignition forced it to accelerate again. So when you fire pistons individually and at every 180 degrees of crankshaft rotation, the rear tire feels a cumulative effect of these brief forces of acceleration as a relatively regular and steady pressure. Good for times when conditions are ideal, but bad when, say, the power of the engine combines with those other factors to cause a loss of rear tire grip. The tire suddenly breaks free of its grip, spins up until grip returns, which it always does, of course, and often so suddenly that the rider experiences a vicious high side. So, instead of a rational firing orders more even pressure under acceleration, a force that makes the tire grip, 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 grip until it suddenly breaks loose, the Big Banger delivers huge torque-filled pulses due to two cylinders firing right before the other two cylinders. The engine's entire power cycle is compressed into a brief double pulse that at high revs, it momentarily overcomes the tire's grip and causes a very brief slip. After the double bang, the tire recovers its grip as the pistons decelerate and progress towards the next combustion stroke. The first theory says that, and we're turning the page, hang on a second. First theory says that series of ultra-brief slips create a unique situation when exiting turns. As revs climb, lateral forces on the tire cause those micro-slips to become sideways movements of the bike's rear end. The rider can use this gradual increase in lateral slippage to sense the limit, just like he could with a bias ply's gradually increasing slippage. Thus, the Big Bang engine makes a radial tire mimic the best quality of a bias ply tire, which is the gradual slipping as it approaches that final limit of traction. And this was the theory back in 1992 when Kevin Cameron explained that Big Bang engine's benefits in Cycle World magazine. It was also thought that compressing the timing of all the combustion strokes gave the tire rubber time to rest up between Big Bangs and thus maintain top performance longer into the race. However, as recently as November 2007, Michael Scott wrote, quote, "The tire people have yet to understand why a syncopated drumbeat of firing intervals should be easier on the rubber than the steady, even pulse of an inline four. However, it is clearly so." Unquote. After many years of considering why the Big Bang engine delivers its undeniable benefits, some very clever people are still wondering exactly what the hell is going on. Which brings us to a more current theory. This is Yamaha's chief engineer, Masao Furusawa. At the end of the 2007 season, Furusawa gave a presentation in which he explained his theory of the Big Banger's benefits in terms of the engine's internal harmonics. Instead of reintroducing a gradual lateral slipping to help the rider sense the limit of grip, the quick dual pulses of the Big Bang engine create a much different harmonic state during acceleration. So, just as the tire in the previous theory can sense this subtle differences in the forces of the accelerating and decelerating piston, the crankshaft in Furusawa's theory creates a noticeably different harmonic signature when the pistons are fired in close succession. Again, we're dealing with milliseconds and with distinct changes in the movement of various engine parts during those very, very brief periods, so friction causes that piston to decelerate after combustion, and so does the necessity of reversing direction when the piston approaches top dead center and bottom dead center. Again, think back to beginning physics and how something moving in a given direction at a given velocity wants to keep on doing just that, basic inertia. After ignition, the piston is moving very quickly down the bore until it reaches the limit imposed by the connecting rod at bottom dead center. Rather suddenly, it is forced to stop and then head in the opposite direction. As it is moving down the bore, it has considerable inertia and kinetic energy, both of which have to be accounted for as part of the reverse direction. Both forces are absorbed by the crankshaft, something that Furukawa called inertia torque, to differentiate these forces from combustion torque, which is the force created by the ignition of the fuel mixture. So just as wind resistance increases exponentially as speed climbs, so does inertial torque increase as the revs climb. So, while inertial torque is a factor in your road bike, you don't operate its engine at sufficient revs to notice a problem. But MotoGP engines run fast enough that inertia torque becomes a very noticeable problem indeed. To explain just how this problem manifests itself on the track, Furukawa used the metaphor of tuning a radio. As you turn the dial, searching for that desired station, you hear the noise of signal interference decrease as you approach a spot where the signal strength is at the peak. The noise is still there, but the interference is low enough that you hear a clear signal. In Furukawa's metaphor, the rider is using the throttle to tune in a good signal to the rear tire. If there's too much noise between the throttle and the tire, the rider doesn't sense a strong signal and he has little notion of where the limit of traction lies. But if the interference is low enough, the rider has a good connection to the tire via the throttle and he can get closer to that limit of traction. Inertia torque is noisy and thus interferes with the rider's ability to tune in a good signal. Enter the big banger, which reduces those periods of inertia torque by compressing the firing pattern. So as the crankshaft is absorbing inertia and kinetic energy from the pistons and connecting rods, it's doing so in a smaller window of its revolution, if you're following me along here. The result is a longer period of each revolution that is noise-free, or at least relatively so. So this gives the rider a stronger signal between the throttle and the rear tire. Now, in spite of their troubled 2007 performance, Yamaha had done much testing of different Big Bang engine schemes, and according to Furukawa, all results backed up his inertia torque theory. Is the Big Banger question answered once and for all? Maybe and maybe not. Scientific history is full of explanations that were accepted one day only to be refuted with more complete data on the next day. That two such experienced and clever individuals as Kevin Cameron and Masao Furukawa have had such different ideas about why the Big Bang design works, it suggests that we may never know in any definitive way the Big Banger's secrets. Given the two theories presented here are decades apart and the older theory is based more on speculation than on testing data, but Michael Scott's recent remark about the tire people still not knowing why the Big Banger is easier on their tires makes plain that there are still mysteries to be solved. We may never know everything because the dominant package in MotoGP last year was a screamer, not a Big Banger. And in spite of the Big Banger successes since 1992, it has not always been the design of choice in the premier class. As a prototype series, MotoGP finds its engineers constantly reevaluating older technologies as newer ones arrive on the scene. The Big Bang engine is no exception and has come and gone according to influences such as continued tire development and various rule changes. The switch from two-stroke to four-stroke engine was a major reset for designers, and the early 990cc engines were, for the most part, screamers as engineers sought maximum horsepower to compete with those holdover 500cc two-strokes in 2002. But when Ducati announced that it would enter the premier class, it went back to the Big Bang engine right away. In February 2002, Ducati course director Claudio Domenicali explained the decision like this. Further analysis led us to decide that the best solution was a double twin, and therefore we designed an engine with four round pistons, which, thanks to a simultaneously 2x2 firing order, reproduces the working cycle of a twin. This will generate the Big Bang effect, making the rear tire work in a way that extends its duration and improves rider feeling when exiting curves. Now, while that first MotoGP Ducati showed a lot of promise, it wasn't until Ducati replaced their Big Bang engine with a screamer in the 800cc GP7 that they won the world championship. Ever since 1992, engineers have faced the dilemma: more horsepower at the expense of rideability with a screamer engine, or less power with an advantage of exiting corners with a Big Banger. Again, each new technology must be taken into account in the search for the current season's best solution. When pneumatic valve systems entered the scene and offered higher revs and more power, once again teams had to reevaluate that screamer versus Big Bang kind of question. As tires improved, teams must decide if this year's rubber is good enough to allow the abandonment of a Big Bang engine. The Big Bang pendulum swings back and forth. Sometimes teams reveal their course choices and sometimes they don't. Ducati announced that the GP7 would be a screamer when the bike was revealed at the beginning of this 2007 season. Kawasaki announced that their 2005 engine would be a big banger as the part of that bike's introduction. And Yamaha switched to a big banger in 2004, but did not publicly confirm that choice until the 2007 season ended. In a recent interview on GP1.com, Randy Mamola said that Honda switched from a big banger to a screamer during the 2007 season. This was likely due to the lack of power relative to the Ducati at the beginning of the year. Honda continued to push the last spring-valved engine in MotoGP to its probable limit of performance, and by the end of the year had the engine that Ducati feared most. So, what are we going to see in 2008? Honda's testing of their new pneumatic valved engine has not been the success they were hoping for, and it looks like Hayden and Pedrosa may well begin the season on last year's spring-valved Screamer until HRC can get the required power from that newer technology. But from Forasawa's presentation, it seems clear that Yamaha will stay with a big banger for its harmonic superiority, though in the aforementioned GP1.com interview, Mamola speculated that Yamaha will certainly offer Rossi a Screamer at some point if their current package continues to lag behind more powerful engines. Ducati is almost certainly going to stay with an updated version of its GP7 Screamer, while Suzuki seems content with their big banger. However, 12 weeks after the last Valencia test in November, the teams went to Sepang, where Kawasaki, a big bang proponent since 2005, made news by testing a Screamer engine. A team spokesman would not admit that the team is moving away from the big bang engine for competition, saying that this was a test of other technologies. And other technologies are always a complication. Honda proved that the big banger was the right way to go in 1992. The dramatic change in tires when radials replaced those bias ply tires made the big bang engine a success, regardless of exactly why the different firing scheme worked. But other technologies happen, and something as significant as a fundamental change in tire construction has arrived that may very well make the big banger a thing of the past, and that is electronic control of power delivery. Ducati's electronics package is said to combine GPS data to tell the computer exactly where the bike is on the track with live lean angle information so that the computer knows just what the bike is doing and it can control the engine's output accordingly. Computer-controlled engine mapping is now done not only on a gear-by-gear basis, but also on a corner-by-corner basis. As electronics get more and more sophisticated, the rider gets more and more help controlling the power, which is just what the Big Bang engine is supposed to do at the expense of the added weight and lower horsepower. So Kawasaki was using a Screamer to test other technologies rather than considering a switch from Big Banger to Screamer for competition? Does a team need to admit that it would like more horsepower if their electronics allowed their riders to get that extra power to the ground? It seems that a Screamer test is more likely a test of the team's electronics to see if the current computer package is capable of taming that added power that the rational firing order will produce. Or, in Furusawa's terms, is the new software sophisticated enough to overcome the signal noise generated by inertia torque and give the rider a good throttle to rear tire connection. So, in closing, the Big Banger's future is far from certain. Advancing electronic control of power delivery could very well spell its demise, or something like the recent spec tire and spec ECU threats could become a reality, which would force teams to abandon the allure of the Screamer's greater power and return to those Big Bang engines. The only thing that's certain is that MotoGP is going to continue to change as engineers search for even a slight advantage of technology. For the foreseeable future, at least, the Big Bang engine will certainly be one of those many factors that they consider. So, thank you very much to Scott Jones. I know you put a lot of work into that article. It was very well researched, and it's impressive stuff. I learned a lot from it, and hopefully my reading of it came through okay. It's always a little difficult to read something that was designed for writing, and I made a few notes and somewhat changed and somewhat edited Scott's things. So any kind of lack of readability or listenability, should I say, on that article is solely mine because Scott had written us up a very, very good article. And again, thanks a lot, Scott. Do appreciate it. All right. We got Jules on the phone. How are you doing today, Jules?
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good. Doing well, myself. It's a nice, bright, early morning. We're definitely looking forward to the season winding down. We were just talking. We got World Superbike coming up this weekend. And MotoGP in, 2 weeks it is? Yeah, 2 weeks. And so that's going to be good stuff. But let's talk a little bit maybe about the kind of stuff that's been happening, basically the IRTA test at Jerez. So, you know, go Hayden. That was one thing I saw, you know, for sure. Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
It would have been interesting, I think, if Pedrosa had not been hurt and had been there, because it'd be interesting to see whether it was, whether HRC has something that they, developed over the winter, or is it really just pure Hayden just finding something, some new speed, some new technique of riding the bike? I mean, he was definitely struggling with this pretty much the same machine last year until, you know, they tweaked some things for him halfway through the season. And, you know, it's great to see him consistent. I think that this year is going to be a Rossi Stoner battle, but Hayden could really, really be a little dark horse in the season if he maintains the kind of consistency he had in 2006. And you know, once those guys are fighting and for the wins, he just gets his couple podiums. He gets, you know, a couple wins here and there, and it could be an interesting three-way. You know,
exactly. If he can step in, like you said, the consistency, which is has always been a Hayden strength, and if he, you know,
it hasn't always been. I mean, he used to be quite the front end tucker back in, like, you know, his first 2 years, but yeah definitely.
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, he's a hard worker, et cetera, that kind of a thing is what I'm kind of getting at. And right. If he can go out there and sort of just kind of do his thing and let the other guys, you know, fight it out between themselves. And you're right, it would be a lot like 2006, and that's kind of all it takes, because he's you know, to a little bit of luck, a little bit of bad luck for the other guys, and some consistency for Hayden. And you're right, he'll definitely be in the hunt no matter what. And like you say, maybe HRC's got something going, and both him and Pedrosa will be going crazy. Now, I thought Pedrosa was going to be able to be back for this. Did you see any news at all about, you know, oh wow, there was some unforeseen delay or something like that? Or
he just decided to sit out the actual. I mean, he did go out on the first day, but he only did like 20 laps, and mm-hmm. he said his hand was hurting too much to continue. So he sat out
the rest of the test.
You know, like the official BMW qualifying session and all the tests after that. And there was an news item that he decided to, that he was very happy actually with the decision, because his hand is rested. He feels much better for the, you know, for the Qatar final test, and then the race itself. So
okay, yeah. Now, not to start a Danny bashing session. I mean, I would never do such a thing. But do you think there's something missing there? I mean, you remember, you know, we've seen so many other riders going out in just the face of incredible adversity, you know, Gary McCoy having to be lifted onto the bike. And even the current crop of riders out there, so many of them, you know, they're just, you just see these guys and I mean, I think they're just nuts. You know, it's like, man, you guys, but do you think that there's something missing there, or am I being a little unfair to Pedrosa? What's your opinion on that one?
Well, you know, Hopper was another guy who pretty much did exactly the same thing. He did 21 laps, I think, 21 laps for his number 21, and then left. I think that there are some injuries that make riding a motorcycle pretty much impossible. And certain hand injuries are going to be, you know, maybe he feels he's ready, maybe he's already got enough testing, which is
that's kind of doubtful.
It's a little hopeful, yeah, definitely. But I think there's certain injuries that, like, you know, like you might think that, like, you know, like a, let's say like a back spasm or something like that. Like Stoner used to have those. Remember they may seem like much worse, like for like walking around, sitting down, and just regular life. But on a motorcycle, it's okay. Like I have this problem all the time. It's like my back goes out, but I'm fine on my motorcycle.
Right, right. Because of the way, yeah, I understand. And also,
but if
yeah,
I hurt a finger, I might not be able to ride for a couple weeks. You know, just yeah. Depends on how, you know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I can't remember who I was talking to, but you know, when last year with when Hoffman was crashed out by Sylvain Guittoli, and yes. then you had
Chaz Davies?
No, the other team rider. Barros. Okay. There, I could not think of his name. Boy, he's gone now from the MotoGP circus, and it's just gone. You know, I had his face in my mind and everything. I mean, I talked to the guy.
The rabbit, man. Come on.
That's bad. But in any case, both Dantin riders had hand injuries, and we were talking, and it's the pressures
that are put on your hands. Name is a lot of
races. Yeah, and the pressures that are put on your hands and wrist and all of that under braking. Yeah, and it, also the hand is such a sensitive, you know, there's so many nerves and everything in there that, you know, the agony. So I guess, okay, that's reasonable. That's real reasonable, and I shouldn't be unfair to Pedrosa. So
I think we also know that like Hopper, for example, is insanely tough. He'll ride, you know, with, you know, half a leg.
Right.
And he decided to skip it out too. So I think that, part of it, I think, is like, you know, it is a competition, and you don't want to compete if you know you're not going to do very well. Maybe it's better to keep your cards, you know, hidden. And yeah, I mean, you're not going to have a chance. These guys are not going to like scare the rest of the field when they're hurt. So maybe right. it's a better idea for them just not to show up for the actual competitive part.
Yeah, that makes a certain amount of sense. And you know, it's also even though it is the competition, you know, to win the BMW and all of that sort of thing, it in the grand scheme of things and over the whole season, it means nothing. So you'd yep. be you're jeopardizing, you know, your possible real results for the races here in a couple of weeks in order to try to win a BMW, which you probably wouldn't have a chance to win anyways because you're riding around in agony and you're not at 100% and all of that. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But in any case, and I saw Stoner did super, super well overall, particularly was it day one or day two where he just – it was day two.
Well, it was during the actual qualifying session, the so-called qualifying session that the he was just – I thought that was – not only like did he ride well, but he played the field just – perfectly. Like he went out there, did just a minimum amount of laps, set the record, no one ever got close. He just sat there smiling, you know. I mean, talk about unnerving. Like the rest of the field is like, oh man, here we go again. You know, he's
yeah, the little bastard's back.
Yeah, little bastard's yeah. back, and he's and like he's ice, man. He's just ice.
Yeah. Do you think he's learning that sort of that side of racecraft, that psychological?
Oh, man. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. He's definitely – I think he's going to be actually a good champion.
He's very good at sucking people out.
Yeah. Yeah. He'll – yeah. And as he matures through the rest of his career and everything, he's going to be one of the names that we'll remember for a long time, I do believe, because he's going to be, you know – like you say, he's going to be he's not super colorful, but he does have some sort of that personality that is, you know, just makes him somewhat interesting. It's mostly, you know, his hatred of interviews and all that sort of, you know, thing, which is not unusual. A lot of these guys don't like giving interviews. So, yeah, he's going to be a good one to follow for quite a few years to come here.
I mean, I think that everybody has different ways of you know, focusing and of you know, the psychological part of the game, which, you know, is very important. You know, Rossi has always been like, I don't really call him I wouldn't call him a clown, because he's more of just like this incredibly happy kid, you know, who I mean, he's not a kid anymore, he just turned 29 actually, but he's you know, the celebrations and like the comments he makes. There's always like this. He knows he's got a great sense of humor and he loves to use it. And sometimes that he uses it to psych out his opponents. Whereas Stoner's more of like a Doohan character. He's not. It's hard not to compare him to Doohan. I mean, Doohan was a guy who, like, you know, psyched his opponents out just by presence. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, he just complete confidence and presence and then of course on the racetrack he just kicked everyone's ass. So that helped too.
Right. And yeah, Rossi is a showman. And
yeah.
You're right. He has that whole clown thing going on, but I do think, you know, that he as a person probably does have, you know, he's a fun sense of humor-y kind of guy. But as we've said before many times, he's very serious. He's all business, and most of the things he do are calculated, and the showman clowning thing is part of it because you know, he'll shut that down when it's not suitable.
Oh, totally.
Totally. And you're right. And then with Stoner, though, it's he's different. He's not the showman in that same sort of sense of way at all, but still colorful in his own sort of way. So
yeah. And just speaking of that whole personality thing, there's a you know, the official MotoGP rider photograph. Did you see that thing?
Oh, the group photograph?
The group photo.
Yeah, I saw it briefly. I didn't like sort of study it while.
Oh,
I was,
man, it's like they posed each one, every single rider according to their personality. Like Rossi's like waving at the camera, all smiling, kind of goofy looking, like his usual. You know, like almost like he's almost wants to lean in for his usual kiss, you know.
Uh-huh.
And there's Pedrosa on the other side just staring off somewhere to the left, this like, you know, bitter look on his face. Stoner kind of smiling but chill. Nicky Hayden looking very friendly. I mean, it's just perfect. They really capture like everybody. It was really well done.
I'll have to take a look at that and sort of pay more attention to it because, yeah, I've just been...
I just laughed when I looked at it because the difference between Pedrosa and Rossi is like, it's like they're like on opposite ends of the spectrum in every way.
Yeah, yeah.
Personality-wise.
And in so many ways they are. I mean,
yeah.
You know, not to start a Danny slamming session or anything like that, but yeah, he's quite, you know, I mean, they call him Danny Bot and all of that. He's just not... He's not a showman. He's no. not comfortable with his celebrity in many, many ways. And you know, it's kind of unfortunate. I sort of almost feel for these guys where they're thrust into it and they have these, you know, issues or what have you, where it's like, you know, in real life, this guy's actually, he's got a hell of a sense of humor and he's, you know, sort of fun and all of that sort of thing, but he just can't seem to translate that to the celebrity factor, and that's part of the whole package, is that how you handle it as far as sort of creating a fan base and being a charismatic sort of member of the MotoGP circus. So I mean, it's not, you know, being a super mega talented writer can go a long ways to can go all the way as far as making up for the lack of that. But on the other hand, if you're also a super good employee of the team, then I think that you can be less on the track. Does that make sense? I know what I'm trying to say.
It's totally true. I mean, you could argue that Nicky Hayden is one of those people, right? Like,
exactly.
He's a hard worker,
charismatic.
He himself
good advertiser.
Is not. Yeah, exactly. He's very charismatic and loyal and you know, he's an emotional guy, but he chooses very carefully what he says. He doesn't say anything stupid. I mean, I've never heard him say anything stupid about other people, just like, you know, like rash remarks or anything like that. I'm sure he says things off camera quite a few times, but he himself says, for example, he's not a very good developer writer, but I think that all that hard work does pay off. He's a champion, and he's always a contender. He's always somebody that you can count on being in the top five in a race and stuff. So,
right, steady and reliable with a lot of other factors that make him desirable as an employee for Honda. And so, you know, a lot of the people that say, you know, why do they keep this guy around and that sort of thing, then that is why. You know, I think Colin Edwards has his sort of strengths in the same way.
Oh yeah,
where you know, he was as Rossi's teammate, he was the perfect teammate, and you know, call facts a fact. I mean, just not quite good enough to beat Rossi, which Rossi likes, and but you know, also good enough to sort of hold up his end of the load, and an excellent development writer in a lot of ways, and all of that sort of thing. So he's same sort of story. You've got more to the package than just your sheer results out there on the track.
Yep. And he's also a really funny guy.
Colin Edwards? Oh yeah. He's cool. Yeah.
He's got great personality.
Exactly. Excellent personality. Again, very, very charismatic. He wrote a article. I think it must have been Road Racer X. He has an article that shows up in Road Racer X now and then. And he's talking about going to all the trade shows and things that he has to do, and the variety of, you know, different sort of love hate relationship with doing that kind of occurs. And it was pretty entertaining. So
I should check that out. I think I missed that one.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. So one of the things he says is nice about doing a trade show in the off season is it's a chance to have a few beers with, you know, fans and friends and whatnot. And then he says something along the lines of, maybe that's why I don't remember the bad parts of doing the trade show or something like that. But
he does like his beer.
Yes. Can't blame him. So let's see, moving on, who else is worthy of note? I mean, of course they all are, but what other sort of any significant kind of stuff did we have happening over?
Well, you know, the Erta test was interesting because we had a weather condition, which we, I think, need to get used to, even though I can't stand it. But we had that halfway rain, halfway dry situation, and some of the usual wet weather rider suspects kind of rose up to the occasion. Anthony West had a good day. Chris Vermeulen had a good day on race rubber, not so good on the qualifier during the actual the official QP session. But So we had a track that was kind of cold and just drying out from wind. There was wind, and I think that last year we had at least like three or four races which were in these kind of unsure conditions, or like the practice sessions or qualifying were in those kind of conditions, and then you didn't really know what was going to happen on race day because nobody really had a chance to test their rubber or whatever. And I think that was actually like kind of like a gift from the weather gods to the field, because they didn't get that earlier. They just had sweltering heat, really, they had rain in Phillip Island, didn't they? They had full-on rain. In Phillip Island. So they had the full gamut for testing. That was actually really worked out well. They got the sweltering heat in Sepang. They got the, you know, downpour in Australia. And then they had this, to me, I think the trickiest, which is that like kind of like misty, wet, but not really wet day where you are constantly looking at cut slicks and should I just try it on slicks, or, you know, obviously you're not going to go out on a full wet. And so that was, I think that helped a lot of the teams kind of get ready for the season more than if it had just been a nice sunny Spanish day. So
yeah, I agree that, you know, there's a lot of different environmental issues and stuff going on. So that is kind of cool. Yeah.
But I think what really, like, the entire off season, I think that it became very clear that that like Stoner seemed to be struggling for a couple of sessions, but you know, these guys, like, you can't go by the times, even if you look at like full race distance times, because they're testing stuff. They may be testing some setting that they know is going to slow them down, and they're just working on how it feels. But I think it's pretty clear that you know, Stoner's very strong and that Rossi's very strong. And I think that the fact that they're on the same rubber is really going to help the season be a competitive one. Those two guys, right, being on the same on the same rubber, and at the same time, I don't think Bridgestone has nowhere near as an advantage like they did last year against Michelin. I think Michelin really stepped their game up. So we may be in for some good racing. Maybe at least for second place.
yeah, I agree. I think so too. That the there's definitely going to be some action going on, and that the tire wars are, I don't know, leveling out, you know, heating up, whatever you want to call it. Where, you know, there is some catch up going on that Michelin has got some stuff to, you know, they've got some stuff right that they did, and they're back, you know, that kind of a thing. Yep. So. Yeah.
So is Honda. I mean, just like the only thing that I'm coming away from this season so far is that we've got a much more level playing field than we had at the end of last year. Of course, at the beginning of last year, it seemed like that too. It wasn't a runaway until the first race.
Right. That's true. And on the other hand, also though, last year we had, for, you know, the first half odd of the season, even though Stoner was doing real well and all of that, but the racing as a whole was still, you know, absolutely spectacular. I mean, we saw some, you know, there was some good stuff.
Oh, of course.
So, yeah, definitely. I mean, the whole season is always good.
Race is probably one of the best races ever.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be good stuff. And like we said, we got the night race in Qatar, and that will certainly be super interesting just for the night sort of factor, if nothing else. Kind of looking forward to that one and see what's going on.
And then we've got Indy, you know. Yes. I think that's going to be an interesting race. Well, it's going to be a great season, of course. It's going to be the best season ever.
Ever. Always. It always is. Yeah. I know, and that's another thing. I'm sort of dying with curiosity to kind of see how things pan out, and is how is Indy and World Superbike at Miller, and what is that going to do, if anything, for attendance at Laguna Seca? That sort of a thing. And, you know, everybody's got theories and there's all sorts of different possibilities. I'm just kind of curious as far as how that's going to shape the whole thing out.
We won't really know until July. They have not sold out. So
no,
usually, but they're sold out, you know, by December.
Did they do that last year? Had they sold out?
Well, not on general admission, but on pretty much everything else.
Yeah. Like now, when's the last time you looked at their site? Are they still, they don't have paddock passes and stuff still, do they?
I haven't looked. I should check, but I wouldn't be surprised if they still had some.
Wow, if that's true, then yeah, it is telling. I'm actually taking a look at their website right now.
But I think that even without Indy, you'd see that kind of tapering off.
Yes. Newness is worn off, and some people aren't going to be willing to come back and all of that sort of a thing. Wow. Yeah, looking at the unless they sort of haven't updated the base ticket sort of page thing, they don't have anything marked as sold out.
Yeah, no, that's,
including some of the camping and things like that, like you say, in the paddock passes that are, you know, those go quick. I mean, the paddock passes in 2005, the paddock passes went off in like 3 days.
In 3 days? Are you kidding? They were gone.
Three hours. Yeah.
Like an hour after they opened the ticket sales.
Yeah, I know is that I delayed something like 3 days to buy the tickets for various reasons, and I could not get paddock passes because they were already sold out. And I was pissed.
Yeah. But then you paid $500 on eBay to get one, right?
Actually, no, I just did not have a Paddock Pass in 2005. Oh. So, and then in 2006, I sold my Paddock Pass for $500, right? But, so, yeah, no, it's going to be that's very telling right there. So I should have thought to take a look at see how ticket sales are doing. I'm going to go with the theory that they just haven't got their site together very well, and that if you tried to buy one, they're going to tell you that you can't. So,
I actually think that is the case. I think that it's just the fever is gone, and also they did change the rules about how many Paddock passes you can buy. Like, people used to be buying them just knowing that they could sell them later.
Right, they did.
Now you have to buy a general admission ticket in order to get a Paddock, which makes it much more expensive to buy a Paddock pass. And so, you know, I think that that whole scalping thing has been taken under control as well.
Yeah, because it was ugly. It was ridiculous. And I remember in 2005, I had a guy at Sunday at noon trying to sell me his Paddock pass for more than the rack rate kind of a thing. And it's dude, things almost worn out now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the our non-American listeners are like, what the heck are these guys talking about? Because, you know, we're actually really lucky at Laguna Seca to be able to get the Paddock passes in most other races are, you get nowhere near the riders. But at Laguna Seca, you get to walk in between the garages and the motorhomes of the riders. There's basically no way for them to get out of there without being seen, without being mobbed. So, the getting into the paddock means you're going to meet pretty much everybody that's anybody in MotoGP, from team owners to mechanics to riders to Dorna officials, announcers, reporters from all over the world. I mean, it really is an amazing treat. Anybody who is visiting the U.S. And think about going to the USGP, you gotta try to get yourself a paddock pass and see that kind of, I think there's very few races during the year that have this kind of access.
Right, exactly, and it is a very cool thing. We are fortunate to have such a, that kind of a thing. Because you're right, it's especially in Europe, it's so much of a, it's getting more and more like Formula One, where the only people that are down there are the mega VIPs and all of that sort of thing. And at Laguna, there is also that level where you see other. Joe Schlupp going, that's actually got garage access and all of that because he has the special paddock pass. But, the other serious Joe Schlupps like ourselves that don't have that, we can, or officially, then can at least get close. And I mean, you're literally still, I'm not even 10 feet away from, for the garage itself. You see the bikes being pulled right in and all of that. It's a cool thing.
Perhaps and it's guys also, are always watching their body parts out in the on the far end of the paddock. You can look at stuff being wheeled around. I mean, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I agree. I like it a lot. And also the other thing with the way Laguna Seca is laid out and the way they have the paddock and all, it's worth the money just to be able to get to a slightly less crowded part on Sunday.
It really is. That's true.
Whatever, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be good. You going to camp with us again?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we had a good time last year.
Is that an invitation?
So. Yeah, sure.
Okay, right on, dude.
I'll share the camping spot with all kinds of people. And I ran in, I did a ride up here with a, friend of a friend kind of a thing. And we were talking about, they had gone down last year and this and that. And this guy apparently has the hookup with somebody who has one of the really cool camping spots at Laguna Seca, the ones where you're on the list and as long as you're on the list, you can continue to get that super camping spot. And were basically
look over
to wait
turn
till somebody
nine or
dies.
Something like that?
What's that?
Were you looking over turn nine?
I'm not 100% sure if where they're located as far as, track view, mm-hmm. but just the, they're more like a real campsite where you've got some facilities and trees and picnic tables and all that, rather than where we camp, where it's just a big field,
dirt and grass.
Yeah. Right, dirt and grass.
So. And no level ground.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we managed to find and that's the thing with that archery is that it got very popular with the RVers because it's about as level as it gets.
Yeah.
And we'll have to make sure that I'm going to get down there a little earlier this year because, I mean, we didn't show up till it was almost time for them to be closing the gates. It was like 10:30 or 11 o'clock or something like that when we finally, at night on Thursday, and driving around looking for a spot. It's like, damn, campsite's already filled up. So I'm getting down there a little earlier, and that'll give me more beer drinking time too. So, but
I don't think we have anything else to go over. But who do you think was the most impressive during the test?
Most impressive during the test.
Actually, during the whole off season.
It's hard to say. I'd probably go with Donor to a point. I think. As a whole, what about you? Who do you think?
I think the most impressive was probably Nicky Hayden,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anybody expected him to be just that strong, and he was strong in a couple places.
Right.
I think that all of the rookies have been showing some incredible strengths already. The Vizioso has been amazing. Lorenzo seems to be getting on very well now. Toseland finally kind of like got over some hump. He was really kind of awful in the beginning, but I think he found his pace is very good. So all those guys, I think. And even Alex DeAngelis did quite well as well. So all those guys, very impressive.
Yeah. This year it's cool because you're going to have an actual contest for Rookie of the Year.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, my money's on Lorenzo, but I might be proven wrong. But it's not going to be an easy sort of runaway, and you don't have the situation where there's there's only one rookie or to choose from and all that sort of thing. It's definitely going to be an interesting field. It's and it's sad to see some of the guys go, old Barros, what's his name that I couldn't remember his name a minute ago, but it's the nature of the business, and the old guys move on and the young guys come in, or in the case of Toseland, the sort of middle-aged guys come in, and it's just the way it is. So poor Toseland, middle-aged, and he's what, 27, something like that. <You know? laughs> So speaking of middle-aged, did you follow at all this whole thing about Michael Schumacher, the rumors from Michael Schumacher?
Oh, yeah. That was around, I think, last winter, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it's just that it resurfaced. And
Right. It resurfaced as if it was not a joke again. Somebody somewhere was like, hey, did you hear that Michael Schumacher is going to be racing MotoGP? And of course, and somebody who didn't have a sense of humor or didn't know that it was a joke picked it up, wrote a story, it went around again.
Right,
that could be a good recurring theme for the next 10 years, you know?
Probably, yeah. Michael Schumacher coming back when he's like 50.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see Carmelo Ezpeleta said that, talking about the whole thing, trying to kill the rumor, he says maybe we'll have him riding with Kimi Raikkonen in sidecar.
Yes. That was great.
Carmelo shows a sense of humor.
I just want to also mention, for all the... There's a lot of we talked about the people who have been impressive. There's also been a lot of people who have been not impressive at all. First, I want to mention that I think I'm amazed that Yamaha Bridgestone for Rossi's team has been able to actually pull it together. They did it very quickly. He was fast right from the very beginning, and he's pretty much the other guy to beat, and. And this just one rider, one set of tire. I mean, I find that amazing that they were able to gather all that data and set up the bike. I'm sure the setup for that bike is dramatically different than the Michelin version. So those guys also, I think, were impressive. I knew that they would do well because they've got probably the best team of mechanics in the paddock, but not this quickly. It's pretty amazing.
Right.
But on the other hand, like, there's a lot of people who just didn't, who are not impressive at all, and one of them that is somebody that I really, really like is Melandri. He just can't get a hold of that bike. He just can't figure it out.
I was just gonna bring up Melandri's name, yeah, and a little concerned. And again, yeah, and I also, you know, I like Melandri, and I think he's got incredible talent. But, you know, they call him the random number generator, and maybe we're seeing that to a point where.
Well, he's not been a random number
generator.
Yeah,
no, he's not generating any randomly high numbers, that's for sure. But, no, I mean, it's just, you know, it's obvious that the guy has his on and off sort of days or races or whatever you want to call it. You know, there's a lot of factors that seem to come into play, and maybe part of it is between getting used to a new motorcycle and all of that, that it just sort of hasn't come into being an on sort of a situation yet for him.
Right. I mean, it's probably, I mean, I'm really grasping at a straw here, but I think that being on the same team as Stoner and seeing how well he can ride that machine around may be a little bit disheartening to somebody who's, like, still trying to adjust to the 800 in general.
Yeah.
Like Melandri. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he knocked some wind out of him to see every time he goes out, you know, Stoner just crushes him in terms of performance, you know.
Yeah, that's a possibility too, because it would have to be somewhat demoralizing, and hopefully that's not gonna, you know, hopefully he can get, if that's true, hopefully he can get over that, because you know, that's not gonna be a helpful situation at all. And yeah, because I do like Melandri. I think he's another one of these guys that's, you know, interesting in his own Melandri way. So,
well, he's certainly fun to watch on the track, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, way. And he's one of the colorful, you know, I mean, his riding style and everything. And I mean, he's not like Tony Elias, where it's just like, you know, what the hell is this guy doing? But it's still different enough that he's good to watch.
I mean, he's a guy who's not afraid to pass. He'll, you know, he's comfortable riding pretty much anywhere, whether it's in front or having to fight it out in the pack. So, you know, he's shown that he can completely dominate a race. It's just, I don't know. I think he's having trouble. I think a lot of people are having trouble with this transition to a much more electronic motorcycle.
Yeah, that's a possibility. What do you think of Suzuki in general? The results we've got going on there?
You know, I think that this is going to be interesting to see this season, Kawasaki and Suzuki. I think that because there was some shuffling around of riders,
mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how much of Suzuki's success was due to Hopper. Now that he's on Kawasaki, or whether it was bikes, you know. I mean, the both Vermeulen and Caparossi said that they were very happy with the bike. The results may not have been so good in Jerez, but you know, it's just there's going to be tracks where Suzuki's not going to be that strong, and it was like not the best conditions. So I don't know. I mean, there could be also sandbagging a little bit. I don't know why these guys would sandbag, but basically, I just don't feel like the tests really show us what we're up against until the season starts, because every team has their own agenda. They're testing things that may slow the riders down purposefully. Not to slow them down, but like they might be testing something that the rider knows is not going to let them go fast. Like I said earlier, and different suspension settings, different tires. I mean, Rossi, for example, said he was not on his top choice tire during this test for qualifying because he wanted to try a different one that he knew might be slower, and it was slower. And you know, he was like, okay, well.
Right.
I know which tire that I want next time we actually qualify for real.
Right, right, yeah. And that's why they call it testing, because that's exactly what you're doing. And you're right. And we can't put a lot of stock in that, you know, the way these test results have showed up, this is how the race results are going to be, because that's just not necessarily the case.
Yeah. But that being said, I think that Suzuki is a little disappointing.
Yeah.
And Honda is back.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Well, all right. I think that because we are recording this in the morning and I have a day job and you have a day job, it's about time to wrap it up, unfortunately. But it's been a good call. A lot of fun talking to you, Jules.
Likewise, dude. So take care, everybody.
Yes, you too. And I will, I'll talk to you again real soon. And I'm sure we'll, you know, exchange emails and all that kind of good stuff too. So we'll talk to you later.
Ciao.
All right, that's going to do it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I do want to say real quick, a little apology. I know I'm not allowed to apologize. I've been scolded about that before, but it's my show and I'll damn well do what I please. That call with Jules, there was a big hiss going on and some other variety of different issues that I would have normally tried to clean up a lot better, but I have been so far behind the power curve as far as being busy and just swamped with life, you know, there's normal stuff intruding. So, yes, shocking as it may be, believe I do somewhat have a life, and I've been trying to keep my interest up in the podcast and keep good shows coming down the pipe and all of that sort of thing. But it's been a little bit of a challenge, and I basically boils down to, sorry, I just did not have time to really clean that call up and do it justice, because I think Jules always brings a great deal of insight to the table, and I always appreciate having him on the show. And speaking of appreciation, another big giant thank you shout out to Scott Jones for that write-up that he did. I thought it was excellent stuff. He went through, he's got his sources listed and all kinds of stuff. I mean, you should have seen the whole write-up. It's 3,000 words long. It's magazine article worthy. I appreciate it, and I hope that I did it justice coming through on reading it on the show, and I hope that you guys enjoyed it too, because I thought it was good stuff. He really did give us a little history of the Big Bang Engine, managed to explain it. There were some mental word pictures and all that sort of thing. You know, move your thumb, turn to the right, and all that. You've identified a torque vector. This is good stuff, and this is a very, very well-written article. So thank you very much, Scott Jones. If you'd like to see more of Scott Jones's talents and all that, go to turn2photography.com. That's turn, the word, and then 2, the numeral, and then photography. turn2photography.com, and you'll check out Scott's good stuff up there. And Steve Jones, we've got a lot of S. Joneses going on this show. Steve Jones has that usmotogpfans.com website. Go ahead and check that one out. Do not forget to enter to the Chicken Hawk Racing competition, where we're going to be giving away a set of Ben Spies' tire warmers. You can do that at chickenhawkracing.com. So check that out. Sign up for the mailing list. Put MotoGPOD in the second line of the address, address line 2, and David will make sure that your name gets entered into the hat for that. And then, of course, always a big giant thank you to Jules. It's always nice having you on the show. And a little teaser for next show, which normally I never do these things because I'm always afraid that if something doesn't work out, it's like, well, dang, I wish I hadn't mentioned that on the last show. But this one, I know it's going to work out. Next week, we got a little bit about suspensions. So we're kind of deluging everybody with the technical articles that people want. And this one is from David Emmett of Kropotkin Thinks fame. Another excellent writer that you really got to check out his blog at MotoGP Matters. But I have one here in the bag sitting right here in front of me. I was actually thinking of reading it tonight, but the show's running a little long. And it's like, you know, I think I'm going to save that for next week. And this is a cool description of what your suspension is doing. So we're going to enjoy that next week and learn a little bit about what the heck the suspension is doing. Because basically, as according to David, I made a dog's dinner of explaining suspension and how it works on my last show. So he's going to set us straight and put it in layman's terms of what the heck is going on. We got that coming up next week. And also one last website or what have you to check out. Go to Mark Callen's website. Like I said, the guy was nice enough to send me a whole giant book of stamps for my son who's doing the boot camp thing in Marines, markcallen.com. And that's with a K. So Mark with a K and then a second K, K-A-L-A-N markcallen.com, markcallen.com. He's a professional photographer as well. So we got two professional photographers going on here on the website this week. But I think that you'll enjoy both of those websites. Mark Callen's also got a blog that he does. And not enough posting still, Mark, like I told you. But it's very interesting stuff. And he's been a longtime friend of MotoGPOD. And we really, really do appreciate it. Now, moving on, one last little tiny bit, little segment that I kind of said to myself, well, I'm not going to bother talking about it, but I think I've established a trend, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what my son did in boot camp this past week. Got another letter from him, and he emphasized again, this is three letters now, that he's mentioned how much he likes the food. And I'm really, really puzzled by this. I think it's the fact that he's probably burning somewhere on the nature of 3,000 or 3,500 calories a day, and hopefully he's getting that many to eat. Because he doesn't have a lot of time. He gets to go in there. He gets his plate full of food. He's got 5 minutes to shovel it down. And so he says he likes the food a lot. Has a wisdom tooth pulled out. It was on Vicodin. Got to experience the military medical system. And no knocking the docs out there. We know you guys are great. But his dental appointment was at 0645. And at 1530, when he was writing me that letter, he was sitting in medical, which, of course, was clear across the base from the dental clinic, waiting for his Vicodin. So a full, you know, 9.5 odd hours or whatever it was to get his tooth pulled out. Yeah, but whatever, he's doing very well down there in boot camp, and I certainly wish him well, and I know that you guys too. I've got a lot of emails from people you know, expressing good wishes and all that towards my son, and I do really appreciate that. And by the way, his name is Alex, and he doesn't seem to be having a very bad time. I haven't no letters where there's crying and sniveling and carrying on about how, what a huge mistake he's made and oh my god, I want to come home or anything like that. He just seems to be making the best of it, and as I get some updates, I will let you know. Today on his training schedule, it was a 2-mile group run, which, oh boy, that sounded like fun. And he also had boots and utes this week, which, if you're not familiar with boots and utes, that means you go on a run, probably, you know, 1.5, 2 miles, 2.5 miles, so I don't know, somewhere in that neighborhood, wearing not shorts and tennis shoes, but utilities. That's the utes part, which means you're the camouflage uniform that you're wearing. You take off the blouse, and you're just wearing a t-shirt. The camouflage pants, which are quite heavy, by the way, and the boots, which are extremely heavy and not very comfortable. So going for a run in that kind of thing, it's good stuff, because eventually these guys are going to have to run in that. And these are some of the areas where the military has changed the training, where, oh, well, you know, we're risking injury to their feet and stuff, so we're not going to allow that. And frankly, I somewhat disagree with that. I think that if the very, very first time that you've ever had to run in combat boots is when you have to run, that's probably not a good thing. So I don't advocate, you know, daily beatings or anything like that, but I do think that train like you fight is an excellent motto. And I think that it sounds like that's what Alex is experiencing. And we got World Superbike starting this weekend in Qatar. World Superbike's going to try and get a couple of races in under their belt before the MotoGP season starts. So that's good news for us. So we got World Superbike in Qatar this weekend. Then they move to Phillip Island, one of the best tracks in the world, the following weekend. And then the weekend after that, we got MotoGP starting in Qatar as well. So the season is upon us, folks. It's finally here. We have ended our long winter drought of racing. It's all about to come to a head. And until later, why don't I go ahead and sign out for now, and we will talk to you next week. Well, apparently last week's disclaimer made me sound like a creepy internet stalker. So we're going to read this one in a new style. This is MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for the content. MotoGP is a trademark for Dorn Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorn Sports SL, and all other trademarks are the property of their respected owners, and MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.